Hey everyone, Jay here.
And Joey.
We're having a lot of fun doing this, and we're grateful to everyone who's tuned in so far. As the podcast grows, we hope to keep everything as independent as possible.
Which is why we've created a Buy Me a Coffee campaign.
Buy Me a Coffee is a great way to support us for as little as $1 or $4 per month, or $40 per year. We're still coming up with bonuses and perks, but we hope you'll consider supporting us while we iron out those things.
Interested in being the oil to this machine? You can find us at buymeacoffee.com/Jay and Joey or find the link in the show notes.
Thanks everyone and enjoy the show.
Thank you all.
You guys got the the radio silence zones. Isn't there like a radio, like an area where there's like no radio allowed or anything like that? Am I misremembering, or is that something
no,
you have?
That's in Green Bank, West Virginia, and it's because there's just this massive telescope, so NASA telescope there.
Nice.
It's beautiful through that area, Yeah, it's got the radio quiet zone because the telescope there. Yeah, I think it's actually the world's largest steerable radio telescope. Do you know the director Werner Herzog?
Yes.
Okay, so he filmed this documentary. It's called Lo and Behold, and it's just about how hyper-connected the world is and kind of how bad that is for society. And he actually visited Green Bank to see what it was like to live, you know, where you're not connected, where you don't have cell service all the time or at any point, like what it's like to be in that quiet zone. And he's just like hanging out with these locals on their like Friday night community dinner where they're all just like picking banjos and like fiddling and stuff. It's pretty cool to see Werner in Eastern West Virginia, just like doing his thing and talking about the human condition and what it is like to have community in a modern society that is so connected in the personal sense without technology. It's just awesome. Like him and these just awesome mountain folk getting down and like, well, 9 o'clock, time to go to bed. Nothing else to do.
Nothing else to do. That's awesome, man. I saw him interviewed by a skateboard magazine the other day.
Really?
Yeah, the skateboard mag was just like, we kind of share the same ethos. And he was like, yes, I agree. And then they started talking about all kinds of stuff, man. Just like the skate ethos, the skate thoughts on society and how they kind of matched up with what Werner was doing and stuff. It was gnarly.
Yeah, he seems like a pretty approachable dude. He's just like curious about all kinds of things. So it's dope that skateboarding publication got the chance to.
Yeah, to talk to him. It's just some dweeb with a hoodie on talking to Werner Herzog. I was like, holy shit, this is awesome.
Welcome to episode 10 of Jay and Joey on the record. We did it. Crack open those Steve Weisers for double digits from the boys.
Pop open that champagne, baby. 10 episodes, double digits.
Next week, I won't be able to count them on my fingers any longer, unless. So I'm Joey.
I'm Jay.
Since this is a round number epi, we're doing things a little different. What's the focus on today's show, Jay?
We decided that for the round number epis, as Joey so eloquently put it, we're going to do artists. You know, for 10, we're going to do an artist. For 20, we're going to do an artist and so forth. So for 10 today, we're going to talk about all of my Rush albums.
Oh, shit, that Rush. I listened to Rush Limbaugh books on tape. Ooh.
God.
But really, yeah, let's talk about your journey to Rush. How did you get there? Why Rush? Do you have any Rush memories? Any cool Rush stories from growing up?
That's the thing, man. There's not like point when I was like, boom, Mr. Rush. It's just kind of always been a band that, even as a little kid, I'm drawn to rhythm sections just by my very nature. And Rush's rhythm section is about as good as it gets. And then just, I don't know, they're different. They're weird. I'm different. I'm weird. They're not the most popular thing out there. So I don't know. I just kind of latched onto them. Yeah, right. Exactly. Everybody hates me.
No, yeah, that's a really good way to succinctly tie them up. Like, they're not terribly popular. They're a little weird, but their flock gets them and they get their flock.
Yeah, they have the things that I like. And we can talk about what those things are. But just in general, Rush, most of the time, has what I like in terms of what they're doing musically, what they're doing lyrically, their attitude towards things. I like Rush a lot. They seem like three really cool dudes, too.
Sure, R&D, yeah.
Neil Peart.
So, yeah, I took this task on very intentionally just because I wasn't too familiar with Rush. I spread the listens out over several days. Like, usually I can get through them in 1 to 2 days, which was a really bad strategy with some of those Hypnosis albums. Oof. But I knew I was going to spread these out and just kind of take them a piece at a time. And you know what? Like, I'm just going to tell you up front how I felt. I had fun. And I kind of liked a good chunk of this, which shocked me. Because I had no problem just shitting all over Rush in the past and just bagging on them hardcore.
I'm over here raising the roof, man, because obviously you had fun, and that's kind of the thing, man. People know the stuff, the Rush stuff that's on the radio, but some of these other, B-sides and some of this weird stuff that they do, it's endearing. Like it has even more drawn me into Rush. And I know a lot of people, good friends of mine, who hate Rush. And the other side of it, I love Rush. Absolutely love Rush. But I also can totally understand the arguments that people make. No, I don't like this. I don't necessarily like this. I get it. If you don't like Geddy Lee's voice, you're not going to like Rush. That's the beginning and the end of the story. But
yeah,
if it's okay, and I actually think it's pretty good, but if it sounds okay to you, and then you move into the actual musicality, the musicianship of these guys, it's really impressive.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the hate maybe stems from how hardcore people like them.
Sure.
And how they're very quick to point out about like the technicality of the music and like that somehow makes it great. I mean, to me, like Jesus Christ could return to Earth right this second, drop an album, and if the first thing people are talking about is, well, it's in 7/8, like,
I get it.
Yeah.
No, I get it.
But
by the same token, like I said before, the lyrics in the, and we'll get into all this stuff, but the lyrics are freaking great too. So at least I think they are. There are some very strong opinions on those lyrics too.
Yeah. And I mean, every band's going to have a fan base like that. I mean, yeah, there are so many great acts who I think maybe don't get the proper praise because how the diehards unfortunately rub people the wrong way.
And that goes for tons of things, movies, yes, TV shows, yep, cars. Okay, so having said our little piece on Rush here, I do not have their debut album. I wish that I did, but we're going to do the albums I do have here in chronological order, starting with Fly By Night. This is Rush's second studio album, came out February 15th, 1975 on Mercury Records. It is, people may have seen this album cover. Joey, had you seen this album cover before?
I have, but I never knew it was a Rush album cover.
It's got a big snowy owl on the front with some big yellow eyes. It's pretty sweet. I'd like to get a tattoo of this on my back.
Oh, yeah.
Just right across the middle, put Fly By Night on my back.
Oh my God, you would be a king amongst that fan base. Or king, yeah. Oh, don't mind me, guys. Just gonna take my shirt off.
Just gonna pop my shirt off and flap my wings a little bit. Fly By Night here. This is really so. Rush went through actually quite a few iterations before they had their first album, which is self-titled. It's just called Rush. The drummer on that one is actually different than Neil Peart. This is when the real power trio got kind of finalized for the rest of their recording career. So this is really the classic Rush lineup in their first album together.
This was Neil's first album.
Yeah, they had a guy named John Rutsey before who, I don't know, I guess just couldn't handle life on the road. I don't know. I've watched if it was the drugs or alcohol or if it was none of that and just didn't want to be on the road. I honestly don't know, but he just couldn't handle it.
It's one of those things where you kind of have to wonder what would Russia become? Because Neil wrote a lot of the lyrics, which is very unusual for a drummer.
Most of them. Very okay. much so. Yeah, he wrote the vast majority, if not almost all of them. And then the funny thing is the Lifeson, Alex Lifeson, the guitarist, and Geddy Lee wrote, they're the composers for all of this stuff. So it's a pretty good combination. You get the, you know, Neil Peart writing the lyrics and then Geddy and Alex Lifeson kind of combining to compose the music, which is pretty impressive.
It seems like they enjoyed that trade-off of just focusing on what they were good at. And they trusted each other, which is pretty great. You don't hear that a lot from a lot of bands. I'm sure there may have been some egos involved, but it seems like they were happy to set their egos aside to put something out.
Right. And that's one of the things I really like about Rush. We're talking about Rush a lot here before we get into stuff. But, you know, Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee, they grew up together. They're buddies in like junior high together. So it's actually even more impressive to me that they stayed together as long as they did, considering that fact. You know, sometimes it's tough to be around people for that much time over that much span and collaborate creatively and, you know, be able to agree on so much stuff. So pretty cool that they were able to keep her going for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I assume they're still friends. I have no idea.
But, yeah, right.
All right. Yeah, let's look at this album.
All right, Fly By Night. It's kind of funny. This is actually a little different than their debut. Obviously, it's a different drummer, but you know, musically, the debut is pretty just straightforward rock and roll. So let's talk about track one here, Anthem. Had you heard any of... let's just talk about side one, actually. Do you have anything in particular about side one that stood out for you here?
I can't remember. Where does the album flip after Bytor?
And the Snow Dog?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed, it does.
Okay, so that one, I mean, that one definitely... jumped out. So looking at Anthem, I thought it was a pretty cool opener, actually. It was a lot heavier than I expected. Yeah, like that opening, it's just a freak out. And yes, it's a bold choice. The transition into gritty rocker was very well done. I mean, that's something Rush does quite well, it seems, is transitioning into kind of an unexpected. Yeah, yeah. How are you feeling with this opener?
I love Anthem. Like you said, it just hits you right in the face. Like we said before, people talk about Geddy Lee's bass playing and Neil Peart's obviously a drumming icon, but I really, as we went through and listened to these again, I was really struck by Alex Lifeson's guitar playing. I think he's a great guitarist, mm-hmm. and he's got a really cool guitar tone. And the way they were, and we'll talk about this too, but the way they kind of adapted their sound over time is pretty cool too. But just rolling along here, you know.
Yeah, I thought it's interesting that you make that Alex Lifeson comment, because one thing that I noticed while going all through this, I'm like, why do people only talk about Geddy Lee and Neil? Like, he's a great guitarist, and it's not that hard to remember a third name. But yeah, best I can.
Yeah, pretty straightforward rocker on that one. Mm-hmm. Still pretty, very much Rush. I didn't have a lot to say about it. I did like it, but it is what
yeah.
it is.
Yeah, this next track, though. Whew.
Yes, Beneath, Between, and Behind. So you gave me a little hoof. What do you got?
It's just not what I was expecting. Like, it was a rocker. I don't know. Yeah, it's not what I was expecting.
Yeah, it is a rocker. And it's tough because I can't remember exactly how the chorus goes or I'd sing mm-hmm. it, but I love the chorus on this song. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it is a rocker. It's a badass song. And this is the first time I was sitting there thinking to myself, okay, I get people that don't like Geddy Lee's voice, but, and I totally understand why, but I, for my ears, I love it. I think he's great. And he does evolve over time, but I think his voice is great. But I can see how a song like this might turn people off.
Yeah, and it so fits them. It's like, how else would you like the lead singer to sound? Like what?
Right.
What would you like, a deeper voice? Would that have worked with Rush? Definitely not. Would you have like maybe down an octave? I don't know. It fits.
It definitely fits. And he doesn't just do this. He doesn't just do the screaming, screeching vocals. He does other things too. But that song's super, super anthemic. Just really big song. So we already mentioned track four here, Bytor and the Snow Dog. What do you got on that one?
I had to do some research to understand like what the hell I was listening to.
Sure.
And So apparently this is about the manager's dogs, or it was influenced based on the manager's dogs. I guess they saw the dogs or met the dogs and were like, oh, let's write a song about this. I can't remember which member of the band. Apparently it was a joke that they said just kind of got out of hand. But this song is fucking nuts. Like,
it is.
I kind of love it, especially when it's like, Bytor, Knights of Darkness.
Yes, exactly. You're starting to feel the rush flow. I'm with you, too. Yeah, man. Across the river sticks out of the lamplight. Ba-da-da-da. Like, fuck yeah. Absolutely, dude. So that's lyrically, it's wild. Geddy's bass playing on that song is super kick-ass. The battle section, when it's just like an instrumental section, it actually tells you the different. So there's four parts to this. At the Tobas of Hades, Across the Styx, The Battle, and then Epilogue. So the section that's the battle is just instrumental. Mm-hmm. And it is super gnarly. Yeah. Just the bass just grooving along, all these crazy sounds and screaming going on. And then
there's like that satanic animatronic growl thing going on. Like, I don't know. Then it gets really solemn. Yeah, then there's that battle. Like, there's just a lot going on. And it's 8.5 minutes long for like maybe 25 lines of lyrics that kind of tells you what you're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say your dogs? You have two dogs. Which one's Bytor and which one's Snow Dog?
So I'd say the big one is going to be Walter. He's going to be the Snow Dog because I do think in this story, if I'm reading it correctly, Snow Dog is going to be kind of the good versus the evil of Bytor. Mm-hmm. And our little dog is a little bit of a terrorist in certain situations. So,
or her name is Loki, so it's very
funny. It is Loki. It fits perfectly. Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, she's a little bit of a monster. That's Bytor and the Snow Dog. I love that song. It's such a weird song, but I love that one. And give me those drum fills. Tons of cool drum fills in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Snapping Inside B here kicks off with, you know, one people would have heard on the radio, Fly By Night.
Mm-hmm.
Love the intro to that one. I always have. This one's going to be very high on my list of air drumming songs because I just love to slam those babies out.
I like how the chorus just kind of, there's that pop at the beginning where it's like, fly by night. And like, I can't hit the note, but it's like, fly by night. Yeah, it just kind of womps you.
Yeah, and then after each line of the chorus, you got a cool little drum fill in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one that just, again, Geddy's vocals are kick-ass. Like you said, it's a register people can't normally hit, but it's, and then again, Lifeson's solo stood out to me again. It's a scorcher of a track.
Making memories. I like the twang and bombacity. It felt like a road tune, you know, if that makes sense. Like you're on the road.
That's literally the only note I have. A song about life, a song about life on the road. We got a little bit of acoustic guitar. That was really it.
Like, it's so cliche and dorky, but it's one of those where I could picture myself just, like, window down, arm hanging out, you know, drumming with my steering hand on the wheel.
Absolutely. So, let's talk about track 7, though, Rivendell. Tolkien fans out there may know what Rivendell is, but it's from the Lord of the Rings books. It's the home of the elves. Any thoughts on Rivendell here, Joey?
So we talked about this a little bit over text, but I mean, Tolkien had such a run and such a tear in the 70s with, I mean, just so many references and that animated Hobbit that you mentioned before. It could have been because he died in the early 70s and maybe people were paying their respects that way. But I wonder if bands were like choosing how they divvied up, like which Tolkien reference they were going to make and like who gets to write this about Tolkien, who writes this and that. My man was on a tear.
Give me that Hobbit shit. Just inject it right into my veins. I'm all about it. I mean, we think about it. We've already talked about Led Zeppelin. Cirith Ungul is a Tolkien reference.
Yep.
Yeah, man, it's a trip. But so Rivendell, just anyway, super slow, little acoustic weirdo song. It somehow it fits in the album. I don't know. I I liked it. And then in the end, just a good little guitar song. I don't have much else to say about that. But okay, so we're through Rush's second album, our first one today. Any final thoughts on it?
No, the last thought I really had is just that it's not a bad start. Like, being recorded... So I read that it was recorded in only 5 days, which is wild.
That is wild, especially considering the complexity of a lot of that stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just as an intro to our week of Rush... It's weird, and that's why I love it. It grabbed me in ways that very few other artists kind of grab me. It's got the right amount of oddity in style and lyrics to satisfy that part of my brain. It's got the right amount of heavy to satisfy that part of my brain. And as we move through here, their style does change quite a bit, but man, it's a good start.
Yeah, one more thing that just hit me. I think that Uriah Heep's The Wizard... I think that was a Tolkien reference. I'm not 100% positive, but it seems
likely given the subject matter and the time period.
Yeah.
And what we know about all of the other Tolkien songs out there in the world. All right.
2112.
Yes. 2112. So this is Rush's fourth album. It came out April 1st, 1976 on Anthem Records. A little background on this one. It was kind of a FU to the label. So the album before this, Caress of Steel, came out and not super radio friendly. It honestly doesn't get very good reviews. And the label kind of said, hey, Rush, you need to give us something radio friendly. You know, something we can put on the radio. And... they proceeded to make an album on which the first side is one giant track. So kind of said, screw you all. We're going to, you know, we got one last shot. We're going to spend your money. We're going to do what we want to do. And I respect that. And I think side A here, 2112, the title track, is really cool.
Yeah, I was not expecting the 20-minute track. So funny story, when I bought my current stereo system, the guy in the store put it together, brought me into the sound room, and just started cranking 2112.
Yes!
He was just so proud of how the system sounded and how good Rush sounded on it. And I was just so disgruntled that I just almost called the deal off, because at that point I was still ragging on Rush pretty hard. And I was like, not what I'm here for, guy. After, and no lie, it was like after 40 seconds, I was like, yeah, man, sounds good. He's like, no, you gotta keep hearing some more deepness of it. And like, I'm good.
I'm good, man.
Yeah. But with that said, it's a pretty good album.
Have you seen the back of this?
No.
Dude, it's got all three of them dressed in all white with like kimonos on. you gotta look it up. Look it up right now, and I'll just kind of introduce the song. Pull that up. You got it? They got a lot of shit for that.
Who's the dude on the left with the who's the blondie?
That's Alex Lifeson.
Okay, his head looks superimposed.
It does. It doesn't like, look it like looks his like neck could be at that angle.
Yeah. Okay. Oh my God, what a turd.
I think when they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Foo Fighters played a tribute to him dressed like this. I'm almost positive. Or they came out and introduced him like this, something like that. But Dave Grohl was dressed up like one of these dudes.
How did the band respond?
Oh, I'm sure they thought it was hilarious. They're that kind of guys. So nice. Anyway, all right. Track one, 2112. It's a kind of sci-fi story, and we can talk about the individual parts. It kind of kicks off with an instrumental overture that ends with just the words, and the meek, I can't even sing it, and the meek shall inherit the earth. Like, you got 4.5 minutes of instruments, and then they hit you with, and the meek shall inherit the earth. Love it.
It's so unexpected.
I wish I could sing.
I really liked the overture portion and how it runs. Like, it runs around your ears and it kind of oscillates between inputs, and there's this part around 1:30 that I'm going to try and mimic with the instruments that I think is just so cool. It's like it's just coming at you like a freight train and just gonna rip through you. I mean, it's powerful. Yeah, like there's Tchaikovsky going on in this song. I mean, lyrically, it's about what you'd expect from someone who loves random sci-fi, but I don't know what else to say. Like, do you have a preferred portion to this? Because you mentioned it with Bytor that some of the songs are in segments. This one is in segments.
It sure is. Yeah. So, kicks off with the overture. Like I said, the instrumental. Then it goes into Temples of Syrix. You know, that one's basically some priests saying, hey, we control everything. Everything needed by society is here at the Temples of Syrix. I think I've heard on the radio those first two sections played together. That's kind of like a single before. I might be wrong there. But the next song is called Discovery. And I really like the idea behind this song. So the song, this part. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got the temple with the priests that control everything. Then we shift to a guy who finds a guitar and learns how to play it. And it's super cool because when Lifeson starts in that section, it's kind of got water running. You can feel like you're in a cave. And then you start hearing somebody playing a guitar in a way that kind of sounds like they're learning how to play it. So he's hitting wrong notes and figuring out how to create a chord and that sort of thing. So I think that's a cool idea for especially the concept, the guy's finding a guitar.
Yeah, and then the part after that presentation, I liked quite a lot. I mean, it's epic, it's loud.
Yeah, so he's gone to the priests with this guitar saying, hey, look at this really cool thing I found. We can use it to inspire the people. We can get, you know, we can be creative with this sort of thing. He's really excited about it. And the priests are just basically like, screw you. We already know about this thing. It's pointless and distracting. That's why the older human race failed, because they got distracted by this music. But the one thing I liked about that is how Geddy Lee changes his voice depending on who's speaking. So when he's being the priest, it's the wild howl. And then when he's the guy with the guitar, it's a little bit more subdued.
Yeah, and then it's a really just bummer of a track.
For sure.
Lyrically.
Yeah, it ends with the, yeah. So go ahead, if you want to.
Well, so I really like Soliloquy, and it's basically this guy, doesn't he wake up from a dream and he realizes it's all a dream?
Yes.
And
yes,
he's in this world without music, and he gets depressed and kills himself.
Exactly.
And then, you go on, because I don't remember the last portion, because the last portion feels very disconnected to the story, but it exists.
It's ambiguous. Yeah. So you're exactly right. He wakes up from a dream. The dream was about a planet where there was music and people were happy all the time and stuff. Wakes up, realizes it's not real, kills himself. What's super sad. Can't live without music. Yeah. Just doesn't want to be alive. But the grand finale is a wild instrumental that ends with kind of a robotic voice saying, we have assumed control. We have assumed control. And it's ambiguous because it doesn't tell you whether it is like good guys taking over this planet where these priests control everything, or it's the priests taking control of the planet. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really tell you. And I think they did that on purpose. I think I've actually seen interviews where they said, yeah, we left that kind of ambiguous on purpose.
Yeah. So there you go. A 20-minute intro, 20-minute track one.
Dude. So that's 2112. It's pretty epic.
Then you flip it and it's nothing like 2112.
Yeah. Track two, first track on side B, is A Passage to Bangkok. That's a song about weed. It's a weed travelogue, basically just talking about all the different places you can go to smoke weed. The main guitar riff, though, is pretty heavy and pretty dang good. The solo's sick. And then again, Neil Peart's drumming is just badass.
Yeah, so this one, part of me really hates the concept, because judging locations by their quality of Beelzebub's broccoli is pretty lame, in my opinion. It just kind of reminded me of backpacker scumbags I would see in Southeast Asia at times. But I also, I mean, I admire their vocal appreciation of left-handed cigarettes and not being able to, voicing that in the mid-70s and letting people know how they feel.
Hey, we like to party.
Yeah.
So, moving on, there's one part about that on that song I like. There's kind of a total silence, and then he makes a sound like he's taking a big drag off of a doobie. It's kind of hilarious. And then Song comes screaming in like a train again. But okay, moving on. We don't have to talk about Passage to Bangkok anymore. Twilight Zone. What a weird song that is. Did you
listen to... No, I don't really have any thoughts on that one.
So I just like it because I like the Twilight Zone, but it's actually based on two Twilight Zone episodes. Mm-hmm. The one where the guy's at the diner and an alien spacecraft has crashed and they're trying to figure out who the alien is. And it turns out it's the guy behind the counter. He's got a third eyeball in the front of his head.
Okay.
And then there's another one where there is a person who's like the toy of a giant little kid or something. So anyway, I like that lyrical content. It got me fired up. Track four, Lessons. That one was the only track on the album written by Alex Lifeson. And I liked it a whole lot.
Did you have any thoughts on that one? Yeah, I did too. It sounded like there was a different guitar being used as well. It's kind of grisly.
Yeah, so and some really great bass playing. The little bass kind of fills in between lines in the chorus is really, really impressive. And that's another one I really like. Getty's voice, it kind of blends in with Alex Lifeson's guitar. They're kind of hitting the same note at times. And then the solo on that one's kick-ass, which makes sense because the guitarist wrote it. So Tears, the only ballad on this bad boy. What'd you think of Tears?
No. So I don't know. The only thing I have is it can go pound sand. I don't even remember it. I don't know why I said such hurtful things, but I wasn't having it.
It's got a Mellotron in it. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a haunting little song. Getty is actually really singing on that one. I mean, he's singing all the time, but he's really, it's a little bit more, I don't know how you want to say it, but I don't know. I liked it, but I couldn't understand why you would tell it to go pound sand because it's nothing like anything else on this album. And then the last one is Something for Nothing. I didn't have a ton to say on that one either.
So yeah, do you have final thoughts?
Nothing beyond, you know, to follow up with what I said initially, this was kind of an FU to the label. It was hugely successful. And after this thing hit, they could kind of do whatever they wanted for a while. So good on them. Way to earn it, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is kind of where you start seeing Rush become Rush.
Yeah, I think so too. The funny thing is, though, let's move into the next one. Mm-hmm. The next one in my catalog is going to be Permanent Waves. So that is Rush's seventh album. And what I say for 2112, is it fourth? So we got a three-album gap right here. And Permanent Waves came out January 14th, 1980 on Anthem Records. Kind of getting started on this one. Do you have any initial thoughts on Permanent Waves?
The thing that stood out to me, I mean, I've got notes on, I think, most of these songs, but it's shockingly short.
It is. And when you've listened to, you know, five Rush albums in the span of 2 days, it's okay to have a short one in there every once in a while.
Yeah.
So track one, Spirit of the Radio. Love, love, love the intro on that one. Huge drums, another big air drum track where I'm just in the car, just beating the hell out of the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. Lyrically, it's a lament on the change of FM radio stations from sort of freeform to commercial based formats. So I like that thought too.
I don't know, man, like maybe it was the right time and the right place, but I had a blast listening to this song. Like the production is phenomenal. It's hitting those major notes. Like I loved it. The chord progression and explosion is just, it's a blast.
Mm-hmm.
Probably That's my terrific. Song of the week.
At the very end, this is kind of the first one, and I'm not super familiar with the album before this. I do like it. It's called Hemispheres, but you know, since this is the first track on Permanent Waves here, it's kind of the first time Rush does that reggae style drumming. The last section is more of a reggae, so the bass is doing reggae type stuff at the end of this, and there's definitely a lot more of that as we move through the next couple of albums.
Yeah, that exactly didn't blow my skirt up, but
I understand. I know you're not a reggae guy.
But this song also made me think of the scene in Freaks and Geeks, that soft intro where Jason Segel's character is just like, he sets up the mini drum kit and drum stage in the basement, and he like puts on the light show and puts on the dry ice and is just hammering away, and then his dad comes in and unplugs it.
Two Freaks and Geeks references in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the episode where the gym teacher, they prank call him, and then they get to draft their own baseball team. That's probably my favorite episode. All right. Let's see. So Spirit of the Radio, song of the week for Joey. I agree. Pretty kick-ass little track. Free Will is another one people have probably heard.
It's early 80s cheesy, but kind of, I don't know, I still kind of dig it at the same time.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, Alex Lifeson's solo in that one's really frenetic and wild. It's also kind of a change in Geddy Lee's vocals. He's not doing the shrieking as much. Like, the last verse is, but the rest of it's really not.
Yeah, I don't remember how it sounded, but I liked when he just kind of yells, like, I will choose free will.
Yes. Track three, Jacob's Ladder. I don't know if you have too many notes on that one. That one is kind of interesting when I was researching this. It was developed on the band's warm-up when they're touring. So when they're doing sound checks, this song was derived from something they would do during sound checks. It's pretty ominous. Yeah, I'm wondering what part of it was the part that they got from the sound check. But it is an ominous song. It's interesting, too, because it's called Jacob's Ladder. It's not about the vision seen by Jacob in the Bible, but rather the atmospheric phenomena that has been named after that story. So it's like when the beam of light comes shining through the clouds straight to the ground. That's what this is named after.
Okay. I just assumed it was named after the Bible, considering how literary they are. Yeah, it's heavy, man. Like, the bass just lands like a giant's footsteps. You've got that synth that creeps in from like 100 miles away.
Let's see. Track four, Entre Nous. I liked reading along with the lyrics. It's a song about his relationship, Neil Peart's rapport with kind of audiences it shows. Entre Nous in French means between us. So, you know, lyrically, he doesn't necessarily love the audience. He's saying, you know, give us space. We're not best friends. And he has a lot of songs that are kind of like that, too. One of the ones on the next album we're going to talk about is kind of the same. Let's see. Last two on this side, Different Strings or Natural Science. Anything on either of those?
Different Strings absolutely cracked me up by starting off with declaring they've come to kill the dragon. I mean, just right out the gate, you know what you're in for. You know what you're getting. But then it's kind of a sexy sounding track at the same time. Like, some real Silk Stocking shit going on there.
I wish I could picture it, because I don't have many notes on it. And I can't picture that. So I'm going to have to go back and listen to that, because I can't picture it. Because now I want to. From your description, I might have got distracted. Dog probably came down and sat on me or something.
Yeah, it's the very first line. Who's come to slay the dragon? Come to watch him fall, making arrows out of pointed words, giant killers at the call. But then gets a little baby making.
I got a better handle on it now.
Then Natural Science. Yeah, do you have anything on that?
Not a ton. It's another song with sections. So section one is tide pools. Very weird. It does feel like you're kind of at the beach with the tide pools. Section two is hyperspace. I don't have many notes on it. I know I liked it. I know I enjoyed this Natural Science. Hyperspace is Groove City. It keeps you on your toes.
I can see how Coheed and Cambria were influenced by this track, and really by 2112 or 2112, as I like to call it. But do you like Coheed? You're a Coheed fan?
Yeah, I've seen them in concert, actually.
Oh, nice. Really?
Yep. Every Time I Die opened in a downpour. Mastodon came on second, and then Coheed and Cambria finished it off.
Great band.
And they put on a good show, too.
Yes.
At least I enjoyed it. Any final thoughts on Permanent Waves?
I feel like it set up the next album really well.
Very much so. I agree totally. So Moving Pictures is the next one here. It's their eighth studio album. Came out February 12, 1981 on Anthem Records. All right. So Moving Pictures kicks off with probably Rush's most famous song, I would say. Definitely a signature track, Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, Lee just, I mean, wields that bass like an axe. Yeah, it ain't a bad song. I remember hating it, but it ain't bad.
No, and the drumming on that one is just incredible. What a frenzied octopus back there. Slamming everything. It's wild. So another eardrum monster for me. the crazy thing about Neil Peart's drumming to me is, you know, he's doing all these crazy fills and stuff, but it's always so perfectly on time. It's so perfect. Oh, the main bass synth riff is another one that they got from something Geddy Lee would do during sound checks.
Oh, wow. They should have just made an album. There's just nothing but them sound check.
It's called Soundcheck.
Yeah.
It's a good name for an album, Soundcheck.
Yeah, that is a really good. Write that down.
All right, track two. Had you heard track two before? Because track two I actually really, really like. Red Barchetta.
Yeah, I had not. I had no idea how to pronounce it, so that's good to know. At times, it felt like if Duran Duran made a prog track, which is okay by me, because I do dig synth.
So the lyrics tell of like a future where gasoline vehicles are outlawed, which at some point I'm totally cool with that. But so they're outlawed. The narrator goes out to his uncle's farm where there's a pristine gasoline-powered sports car that he takes out and drives around in the country, even though it's illegal. Mm. And some hover cars find him and try to run him off the road and kill him. So, oh. And he manages to escape and get back to the farm. I've always enjoyed the lyrical content on that one. Track three, YYZ, I think it's YYZ is how it's supposed to be pronounced, but yeah, I don't want to be a snotty little shit and say that.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, it was goddamn Canadians.
So YYZ is the airport identification code for the Toronto International Airport. It's interesting, too. So the band was introduced to the rhythm by Alex Lifeson, because it would actually broadcast the signal YYZ in Morse code. So he showed them that rhythm, and then they developed it into this super cool instrumental with all sorts of time changes and all sorts of cool stuff going on. It's really just heavy. Interestingly, because I kind of compared some of the stuff they're doing to like Police reggae type stuff, this song was nominated for a Grammy for Best Instrumental Rock Song and lost to the Police's Behind My Camel. So I guess it just speaks to what else is going on at this time period, because some of these other songs do feel like they're Police influence.
Yeah, I was about to say maybe they just got confused and thought it was Police based on how similar some of their stuff sounded.
So track four is Limelight.
Like, I can see why this is a fan favorite. It's got some cool transitions, like a little calm, a little boisterous. It's very accessible.
Yeah, and I think Lifeson's guitar really shines on that one, too. Mm-hmm. I love his solo on that song. And the lyrics are kind of interesting. You know, I can't pretend a stranger is a long-awaited friend. So, again, it's kind of Neil Peart saying, I don't really care to fraternize with fans. And that's how he was. You know, Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson would come out and talk to the fans, hang out with them, you know, that sort of thing. They're those kind of guys. And Neil Peart was not. So a lot of his lyrical content's along those lines.
I wonder if it was like an anxiety thing or an introvert thing, or
I think a little of both. I honestly do. I don't think he ever felt comfortable. You know, rolling into side B here, The Camera Eye, that's a two-parter. Part one is otherwise kind of known as New York, I think. And then part two is London.
So I don't know how to describe this track.
Yeah, me neither.
The first part, yeah, it feels like I should be skydiving. The opening part feels like, do you remember in the early 90s, some mall arcades had them, but they were usually at like amusement parks where they had these flight simulator things where you would like put on the 3D glasses and you're like, oh my God, I'm floating in cloud. It felt like that. Like, I don't know.
I got to experience that. That sounds like something I missed out on.
Yeah. And like everyone's looking at you like an idiot, 'cause you're just like smiling and waving your hand with this big dumb thing on your face. But I don't know.
Kind of a jaunty light verse on that one, at least on the first part. And then jumping into the second part, very synth heavy. It's kind of showcasing their musicianship. Song six, Witch Hunt. I like that one. So it's kind of unlike a lot of Rush songs in that there's a lot of studio production on that one. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of percussion instruments, overdubs. They had a totally different keyboard player come in. Normally it's Geddy. Yeah. So he's the bass player and the keys. So he's playing the synth and the bass on this stuff.
Okay. I wonder if he ever played them at the same time. I've been a pretty sweet thing to do live. Oh, man, I bet the
people. It is pretty cool to watch when they're in concert, because he'll walk over to the synth with his bass around his, you know, slung across and just play it and then put a loop on and then play the synth. It's pretty sick.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a hell of a musician. So the one kind of fun fact, and Witch Hunt is kind of a cool song. I thought it was kind of dark and foreboding. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, it's got kind of a rabble of a you know, a crowd, because they're burning a witch. It's about a witch hunt. What they did is they just recorded the band and some other people just shouting, and they were all drunk on scotch, and they recorded it about 12 times and then just laid it on top of itself, so it sounded like a bigger crowd. That's how they did the first part of that song. So I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's ingenious. I wonder if that was intentional or if they were just like, hey, why don't we make the most out of our debauchery?
We need to make this bigger.
Yeah.
All right. So, final track, Vital Signs, very much reggae police vibes on that one. Any final moving pictures thoughts?
No, I thought this was a good wrap-up of the Rush that I was familiar with.
This one was a little bit more radio-friendly, too, than some of the other ones we listened to.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
Alrighty, so the last one in my collection today is Signals, another one consecutive. So we just heard the eighth one before they heard the seventh. This is Rush's ninth studio album. Came out September of 1982 on Anthem Records. Track one, Subdivisions.
Lots of Moog.
Yes, tons.
A whole lot.
Some kick-ass bass playing on that one. That's lyrically, again, it's kind of shameful to admit that lyrically I identify this one. It's kind of about people not meeting like the social standards, but like nerds, really is what it is. Like people just nerd. So people who don't, you know, match up with the social norms, who don't conform or kind of cast out. And that didn't really happen to me, but I'm definitely a nerd, like for sure. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and I appreciate them being so open and embracing, saying, yeah, give us the weirdos and the outsiders.
Yes.
Like, it's cool to not be cool. It's okay to just be a normie.
Yeah. Totally. And the, like you said before, a lot of Moog. This is definitely a synth heavy album. And this one, this is their first really fully keyboard centric song. The guitar really is playing rhythm. The lead guitar, Alifeson's just playing rhythm basically the entire time, because the synth is really the center of the stage. Track two, another one kind of along the same lines, Analog Kid. More of a straightforward rocker. I like that one.
Yeah, it's really hopping and skipping.
Yes, as the kids are saying.
It's high tempo, but the lyrics are calmer. Like, they're not somber or anything. They're just very reflective.
Track three's Chemistry. I had no notes on Chemistry.
Yeah, I just put it's a Rush song.
I actually have two words. They read, it just, and then I didn't say anything, so I must have lost my train of thought. Track four, the kind of parts of Analog Kid, Digital Man. Getty is going absolutely freaking bonkers on that track. The bass on that song is tremendous. I love the bass on that one.
It is funky, but I mean, I got very, very strong Police vibes.
Very much so. Yep, I agree.
I'll tell you what I love, though, about this. Fade outs. Man, fade outs are underrated. Bring them back. Like, music needs to bring back fade outs.
People don't like fade outs, but I don't mind them at all. Let's go.
Yeah.
Fade me out. Put two on the side of fade outs here. Side B kicks off with The Weapon. Lots of synth on that mother jammer. Track six, New World Man. It's another, I mean, you just mentioned the Police. This one is, this is the most Police song on the album, I would say. I do like it. I love the Police. I got several Police albums, so don't get me wrong. I like it, but it definitely falls in line with that Police sort of thing. Sure. That's another one where Lifeson's playing the rhythm. You know, Getty's bass is kind of the main thing.
Is the last one Losing It?
No, there's one more after Losing It. Losing It's track seven. What do you got on Losing It? What a depressing ass song lyrically that one is. Did you read the lyrics on that?
Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to say was, man, again, heavy as the head, I guess. Losing, I really like the fiddle playing. That was my other note on this.
The electric fiddle, yes.
Yeah.
I agree. And then track eight is Countdown. Did you have anything on Countdown?
I didn't
seem like you even knew it was there. I didn't really either, but here's the thing. I did listen to it, and I enjoyed the fact, so Countdown is actually lyrically about the first launch of Space Shuttle Columbia. Hmm. The song, so it actually has some audio communications between astronauts and ground control. But the thing I thought was interesting about it is the reason this song got written is the band actually witnessed that shuttle launch. They were there, like in a VIP section to watch the shuttle Columbia take off. And it was so impactful on Neil Peart that he wrote this song about it. So pretty cool. I guess perks of being
How did they score that? Like, is VIP?
I don't know. And it's wild too, because the story about it was they were there to see it. They had to scrap the launch because of bad weather. They went and played a show somewhere else and then took a private jet back later on from like Minneapolis to Florida to watch this shuttle launch. So they were actively trying to get to the shuttle launch. It wasn't like they were just kind of like, we're here in the area, let's watch it. They took a private jet back to see it.
The intentionality of it? Yeah, it makes me love that story even more.
That's the last one. Things I haven't mentioned, but one of the things I've always impressed me about Rush is it's so much sound coming out of three dudes.
Yeah.
On every single one of these albums, it's a trio. And I mean, there's obviously trios and duos and solo artists that can put a bunch of sound out there. But man, these guys, it's just so much sound coming out of three guys.
Yeah, I was going to add something like that. I mean, it's so, there aren't too many great bands who have three or fewer people.
Last note on Signals, actually, specifically. I just thought this was funny. Geddy Lee's a big baseball guy, just for those people who didn't know. He donated a whole bunch of baseballs to the actual Negro League Baseball Hall of Fame in Kansas City, signed by players from the league. 200 of them that he had collected over there, just donated them to the museum. So really cool. He's a big baseball guy. So
holy cow.
It's a really cool museum. If anyone's ever in Kansas City, that one and the National World War I Museum are both in Kansas City. Both are definitely worth a visit. So he's a huge baseball guy. And on the back of this album, all of the personnel, not all of them, actually, that's what I thought was interesting. Certain personnel listed on the back of this have baseball positions next to their name. So
really?
Yes. For example, Geddy Lee is listed. It says Geddy Lee, bass, synthesizers, vocals, pitcher. Alex Lifeson, electric and acoustic guitars, Taurus pedals, first bass. Neil Peart, drums and percussion, third bass. And it's not just them, though. If you roll through here, the funny thing is it's not everybody. So occasionally you'll get just like stage managers, Nick and Liam Burt, shortstop. So it makes me wonder, okay, did they just do this for fun? Or did they actually have like a team of roadies and themselves that would occasionally play other bands? I don't know. But I thought that was super funny and interesting.
That's so amazing and random.
I had no
really
idea.
Cool. Yeah.
I had no idea he was a big baseball guy, actually, until being a Rush fan, I still didn't know until I went to that museum and had some cool exhibits. I do think maybe I've seen them play a national anthem before, a baseball game somewhere before. But that's it. That's my last little fun fact on Rush.
That's an incredible tidbit to wrap things up on.
Yeah.
So let's slide into Didn't See That Coming.
There is an episode of Futurama where Fry, the lead character, has to defeat some space invaders with a device that is sort of similar to an 80s arcade game. He begins his defense of Earth by saying, "It's Friday night, I've got no date, a 2-liter bottle of Shasta, and my All Rush mixtape. Let's rock." So my question for you is this. If you had to jam out to a band's mixtape and set the high score on an old school arcade game, what band and what game would you pick? If you had to set the high score on the game, who's soundtracking that?
Oh, man. I know the game. So game, I would go with Paperboy.
Okay.
Yeah, the original one, because growing up, I was pretty bad at it. But I feel like as an adult, I would be better, hopefully. Soundtrack. I would probably... Who'd be a good... Because it's got to kind of keep up with that frantic... The Ramones.
That's, okay, yep.
Yep.
I like it. Hands greasy from eating arcade pizza. Big old... Put the Ramones on, whip a little Paperboy ass. I like it. I think, honestly, Rush might be my pick for a band. If I had that same question, I might go with Rush.
What would be your game, though?
I don't know. I'm good at Mario Brothers 1.
Ooh,
like, okay. Really good. But I don't know if that would be my pick or not.
Even that World 7 where it gives you the doop if you don't.
Oh, I already know the pattern by memory. I don't need that.
They used to chat my ass so hard. Ugh.
I could play that on mute and still figure it out. All right. Yeah. What do you got for me?
To kind of tie it back to something we were talking about earlier, what is a band or piece of pop culture that you wish that you could get into, but just can't or haven't? And is it anything where the fan base turns you off? Like, what do you think that last hang up and hurdle is?
It's funny you say that because truthfully, there are so many different things that I have never gotten into just because of so many people bombarding me. Hey, you have to do this. You have to do this. No, I freaking don't. I don't want to read Harry Potter. I've never read any. I've read 2 Harry Potter books. People are going to get pissed off about that, but I've read 2 of them. I got other stuff going on.
Yeah.
I got Rush to listen to. So, I mean, but it's not just that. I mean, it's all sorts of stuff. I've always just kind of been like, I'm just trying to think. There's no real fan base that turns me off necessarily. But if somebody tells me repeatedly to do something, there's a decent chance I'm not going to do it at that point, especially if it's something I don't have to do.
I feel like, you, man. Leave me alone. Dude, I'm 100% with you. Like, I've never seen Back to the Future. I've never seen any Indiana Jones. I've never seen Breakfast Club. Like, there's so many, you know, quote unquote iconics where it's like, oh, you have to. Like, do I? Like, will I disintegrate if I? I'll tell you who would be my choice because I feel like like they could be kind of fun. It's definitely the Grateful Dead. I wish I could get it.
I don't hate them, but I also do not go out of my way to listen to the Grateful Dead. But there, every once in a while, a Grateful Dead track will come on. I'll be like, oh, okay, I'll listen to Touch of Grey. I could listen to Casey Jones, Sugar Magnolia. I'll do that.
All right, so. In a hurry to get out, making a mad dash to your next podcast? Well, don't rush out too fast. Please subscribe. Give us a 5-star rating. Tell others about us. That's a great way to boost our listenership. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JandJoeyPod. We have a Buy Me a Coffee. You can find those and our Spotify playlist through the links in the show notes. And as always, be good to each other.
Check out those Spotify playlists. You're going to want to hear this.
We almost made it through the episode without saying a slap in the bass.
You know what? That's a good movie. I don't care what anyone says. Movie. I Love You, Man is a great movie.
Yep.